迎收看美国之音的焦点对话，我是樊东宁。1972年2月，美国总统尼克松访华，开启了美国对中国的接触政策。不过在50年后，有许多的美国学者开始反思接触政策对美国所带来的利弊。那我们今天要来看一看，有一本叫做《美国第二》，美国精英们是如何让中国强大的一本新书。这本书讲述了在美国开启了和中国的接触政策之后，美国的精英们，包括政界、商界和学界的领袖们，受到了中国广大市场的诱惑，是如何成了中国共产党的说客，帮助中国变得更加强大，让中国最终成了美国的对手。美国之音记者思阳最近专访本书的作者Mr. Isaac Stonefish， 他的中文名字叫做石宇。他曾经在中国生活过6年，担任过《时代周刊》驻北京的记者。石宇在采访中表示，他反共，但是并不反华。我们来看专访内容。
嗨，你好，石宇先生，谢谢您接受我们的采访。那我呢，周末的时候就是把你的书读了一遍，但是 But I still have questions for my audience. So yeah, thanks so much.
好，我也非常感谢有机会跟您聊，非常感谢美国之音有机会广播我这个采访。
So the first question, what is the main message of your book, and what motivates you to write such a book?
So 我就一边用中文一边用英文。So what motivated me was when I 我从2006年到2011年一直在北京，搬到美国的时候，发现很多美国人，尤其是美国的一些 elite 什么的，他那个解释中国、描述中国，不是用独立的语言，也不是用中国人的语言，而是用共产党的语言。So I thought that was very strange. Why am I back in the States and listening to Americans speak about China?And using Chinese language, Chinese type concepts of propaganda. And so I started to research how exactly the Chinese influence came into the United States. And when I was in China talking to people about it, I would always say, oh yeah, you know, 现在是东方压倒西方, but I realized it's not about 东方, 也不是跟中国的影响, 而是共产党的影响。So I wanted to be very clear, you know, as I was writing and as I was doing it, 我不是反华，我是反党，反华反党两码事，必须隔离这两个概念。
Okay, so could you give us an example what kind of language you heard in the United States?
So people would say often, oh, 中国有五千年的历史 and the idea is not China doesn't have 5,000 years of history.Rather, the idea is that the party uses that phrase to imply that they are now the legitimate successors of all of Chinese history, and that because China has so much history, the party is now the pinnacle of that history. 叙利亚也有五千年的历史，埃及也有五千年的历史 but we don't see them that way. We don't see them as these historical civilizations reaching their pinnacle because they don't have the Communist Party.Advocating those things. Another one is China has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Well, the Communist Party also kept hundreds of millions of people out in poverty from 79 to, you know, the early 80s, really, late 80s. And that's another phrase that implies, oh, well, the party is the reason why people are out of poverty, as opposed to saying, well, actually, Chinese people worked incredibly hard in the 80s, 90s.And today to bring themselves out of poverty. And a lot of it was despite the party as opposed to because of the party.
So what is the main message of your book?
The main message is there's a lot of negatives coming from the Chinese Communist Party into the United States and that there's a way of fighting back without being McCarthyist and without being racist.
And in your Twitter, you wrote like this, among other things, I argue that Henry Kissinger is an agent of Chinese influence and the American most responsible for the problem with China today. So my question, why Kissinger among so many is the American who is responsible? Who is responsible for the problem in China now?
He is the one, not the problem in China, but the problem
with China.
Yeah, with China in the United States. So since 1972, and especially since 1982, when Kissinger started Kissinger Associates, he became the most prominent American constantly advocating for closer ties with China. And he didn't do this because he thought it was in the interest of the United States. He did it because he thought it was in the interest of China and Kissinger Associates and Kissinger. And I think it's helpful to talk about the concept of friendship. It's when Mao would talk about Edgar Snow, he would give him the title. He would be 斯诺朋友, 而不是斯诺先生, 斯诺记者, 斯诺朋友. And the concept of friendship, I think, is quite important. Friendship is another Communist Party term. It's similar to the idea of lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. 它是一个干部的一个概念。 它的意思是说你是中国的朋友，这意思是你是共产党的朋友。 你是帮共产党扩展它的影响。It's a very specific term, and for so long, people would be using it very loosely. They'd say, oh, great, you're a friend of China, you're a friend of the Chinese people. Well, what it means is you're advocating for the party's policies, and Kissinger is the most prominent friend that China, the Communist Party, has ever had. And I think several people writing about this will describe friend means you're in lockstep with the party. Friend means, I think one person described it as sort of a running dog for the party. People use those kind of terms, but it's not the expression that we think it is. And I think what Kissinger has done over the years has really shaped the way that Americans view China, but it's not a realistic perception of China. It's a China that the Communist Party wants to portray internationally.
Hmm. Could you give us some examples of Kissinger, how Kissinger reshaped the Americans' idea about China?
So in the mid-1990s, Newt Gingrich wanted to advocate for more independence for Taiwan to resume its UN seat. And he talked to Henry Kissinger about it. Kissinger said, no, that's not the way we do things. And he used his gravitas and his influence and his charm to convince Gingrich, well, this is a bad way to go. There's countless examples of that throughout U.S. policy and policy in other countries.
So, 你刚才谈到基辛格，那么谈到基辛格的话，我们肯定会说到尼克松。那么50年前。 尼克松是访华，就是这个月是他访华的周年。那么，如果 Kissinger is the agent for Chinese influence， 那么尼克松是什么样的？你觉得尼克松访华是一个什么样的？是错误吗？
我觉得不是错误。 I actually very much support what Nixon did, and I think Nixon had it right, and Kissinger had it wrong. And I think too much attention is paid to the actual trip, and much less is paid to what happened afterwards. Nixon, as we know, left the presidency in scandal, but he didn't go into consulting. He didn't become a business person. He accused Gerald Ford of selling the presidency after leaving office by joining so many boards. And Nixon maintained a relationship with China, but he did so as an elder statesman, as opposed to as a business person. So when Nixon would go to China, he would visit with policy aides. When Kissinger went to China, he would visit with other business people who were his clients. He went several times with Maurice Greenberg, the then head of AIG, and helped him open up his business and expand his business in China, whereas Nixon would go and talk about policy. Nixon was far more critical to the party after Tiananmen Square than Kissinger was. And I think that's also a very meaningful thing.
Now, aside from Kissinger, you also names the names of lots of political leaders and also business leaders. So people say it's so like provocative. Your book is so provocative. So how did these leaders make China strong and compromising the U.S. national security and national interest in your view?
They suppressed criticism of China and amplified praise and created this system that we've had, you know, until recently, where it was taboo for business leaders, it was taboo for some ex-politicians to be very critical of China. And it's not, oh, 我怎么样也必须说中国的坏话. It's, well, actually, if I'm, you know, 客观的来讲, these are my opinions, these are my views of the country. And there, the idea so long was, well, we can't say these negative things because it could offend the Communist Party, it could offend Chinese people, it could make it more difficult for us to do business in China. And it was just these very constraining frameworks that prevented a really healthy debate in the United States about how we should deal with China. And so over the last several decades, we've had these different intellectual frameworks about how the U.S. should work with China. So in the 70s and 80s, it was, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. China's an enemy of the Soviet Union now, so we should work with China in order to push back against the Soviet Union. And after the Tiananmen Square massacre and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it was, well, that no longer works. And China just massacred students on, you know, in front of a wide world audience. So we need a new justification. Well, how about if we do business with China, they will liberalize. So us expanding our economy into their country will be both better for them and better for us. That was the justification until really the mid-2000s, when China started to grow stronger internationally and started to push against U.S. interests. And then it was, well, we can shape China, we can make them into a responsible stakeholder in the global system that the U.S. built. And really, we're still trying to figure out what this next narrative is. All the other ones have been faulty, especially what happened in the 21st century. And now, really, we're in a place where it's very likely that the U.S. and China will be on opposing sides of a war, and there's not nearly enough national debate. Is that the right way for the U.S. to go? Is that not the right way? How do we talk about this in a way that doesn't get constrained by the business community trying to expand its operations and influence in China?
So this is also the same case with academia and also Hollywood. Why these two industries, you single these two industries out?
Hollywood I singled out because it's probably the most pro-Beijing sector of U.S. business, and it's such an important vector for transporting propaganda. I use the term propaganda very broadly. It's political speech intended to influence, and a lot of what Hollywood does is that. Hollywood, like it or not. And Hollywood is so scared of offending the party that Hollywood movies now, whether they like it or not, often advocate for Chinese Communist Party interests. And what really influenced me in that chapter, 我在重庆看了那个 战狼2, 发现他那个电影的那个第一段是一个那个是 the main character fighting a back against greedy, rapacious real estate developers. But, oh, 他这个非常非常爱国的电影有中国的敌人在里头。 而所有的好莱坞的电影，连一个中国的敌人也没有。And I thought, wow, even this most propagandistic, you know, 非常爱国的一部电影有中国的敌人，而美国没法做。I just thought it was very, very striking that a Chinese movie could have a Chinese villain, but nowhere in an American film. For universities, universities are far more open, far more forthright about China, far more realistic about China than Hollywood is. But they're such important sectors of U.S. knowledge generation. And I thought the way that people in this Chinese studies field would be so careful about certain things was a discredit to the pursuit of open knowledge. You know, you have to be able to advance ideas. So many people would say, oh, you know, 我不谈政治. And it's, well, you have to. That's so you can't talk about China and not be intensely politically focused. you know, or you can't ignore these things. And I found that to be a disservice to ideas of academic freedom.
这本书在美国引起了很大的反响，有许多智库都对此进行了讨论。不过有人认为作者的说法实在太有争议，因为在美国的确有许多人真诚地相信和中国加强中网是件好事，因为可以通过促进中国的经济发展来推进中国的民主进程。但另一方面也有人认为作者在书中举出的大量的实例令其论点很难被反驳，那就是美国的精英们在协助中国壮大的同时也在损害美国的利益。下面继续来看专访内容。
There are people saying that your book is quite provocative. I'm curious about one thing. You know, it's unimaginable in China when you singled out so many names of people in higher places, you will be in trouble. I wonder whether anybody filed any complaint against you after your book published.
Nothing after the book. I mentioned in the book, you know, pushback that I got from Kissinger. I also felt it was very important. 在这个书里也，我觉得这个书也算一个自我批评，一个解法线。因为我批评很多人的错误，也批评自己的错误。There were so many times where I 自我审查 ，so many times where I did things that I feel like were inappropriate within the context of how to speak and talk about China.So many times where when I was there, stories I didn't report or questions I didn't ask because I was afraid of offending the party. I was afraid of losing my visa. So I don't want to put myself above this. 我不是一个榜样，我也是一个 you know, experience these things 的一个人。So I thought that also would be helpful in the process of explaining and of criticizing others.
I think you also mentioned in your book, there are people in the United States who are genuinely believe that they are doing the good things for China, right? So not just for China, maybe for both of the countries. So what would you say to them?
I have a lot more scorn for people like Kissinger who are doing this for their own interests. There are plenty of brilliant people.Who come to different conclusions about this than I do. And I think that's great. I don't agree with them, but I applaud their, you know, their critical thinking. And there are plenty of people in US think tanks, plenty of US journalists, plenty of academics who just disagree with the conclusions and don't think that the Communist Party, you know, is an enemy and think that we are misunderstanding what China is doing. And I feel like that's part of having a healthy debate. It's people doing this for financial reasons, people doing this out of fear, people doing this out of censorship that I have a lot more problems with.
You also mentioned in your book that the U.S. public is now aware of what the Chinese friends is doing in the United States. So, and also with China's Wolf Warrior diplomacy and also with the pandemic, I believe lots of Americans is like increasingly aware of the thing. So do you think that will help end the practice?
I hope so. It's tough because I want them to be increasingly aware of what the party's doing, but I'm also worried about the increasing anti-Chinese sentiment and violence against Chinese people. And I think it has to be very focused on the party and you have to be able to separate the two of them. But I do feel like, generally speaking, this is a good trend. And I am heartened to see what the Women's Tennis Association has done in support of Peng Shuai. I am heartened to see the way some politicians are now speaking about China. I do feel like that's becoming more and more realistic. But...It is a line that people have to walk.
So your last chapter is about defending the rights of the Chinese and the Chinese Americans. Why? Are you worried that your book will cause paranoia and xenophobia?
I hope not. I am worried about that. And I do. That's why I ended the book with that and with the plea for that. The United States has such a terrible history of anti-Asian sentiment, of you know, what we call the yellow peril.This idea of this sort of very Orientalist idea of, you know, masses from the East coming and taking over. And I'm really worried about encouraging those ideas. And I strongly condemn them. I'm also worried about our history of Red Scare and McCarthyism and rooting out communists. I think our system is strong when it allows for these different views. And there's, I think the needs to be a separation between people doing this for illegal reasons, for business reasons, and people just generally holding these views. I also feel like that there are so many Chinese Americans and Asian Americans who just naturally are very, very critical of the party. But when they see people denigrating Chinese or Chinese Americans, it makes them more sympathetic towards China. So I feel both for strong ethical reasons and strategic reasons, it's really an important part problem to address.
The last question, but not the least important one. So where does the title of your book come from, American Second? So what?
我开玩笑的时候说可以把它翻译成美国很二。 但是他那个 title 是来自于 Donald Trump's "Oh, America First," and you know this inappropriately nationalistic idea of, well, we need to sort of sweep all these things aside. But it also comes from the idea that, unlike Russia, which is pushing for chaos's sake, Chinese influence globally is much less about weakening other countries and much more about strengthening China. And I do think that's an important distinction to make. The idea is that Beijing wants China to return to the center of the known universe, for it to be the world's most powerful country. And a lot of what Chinese propaganda does is both imply China comes in peace, China's a very peaceful country, but also resistance is futile. This will happen. China's rise is inevitable. And I push back from both on both of those ideas. And I also wanted it to stand as a warning call that if we just ignore these things, if we keep doing business as usual, the United States won't be the world's most powerful country. And perhaps that's inevitable. Perhaps that's okay. Perhaps that's preferable. But let's have a debate about it. And if it's not something that should happen, what do we do about it? How do we fight about it?
谢谢您接受我们的采访。
好的，我们非常感谢美国之音记者思阳的专访，也要感谢听众和观众朋友们您的收听和收看。提醒您，受访者发表的是个人观点，不代表美国之音。我是樊东宁，祝各位平安，我们下次节目再会。1972年2月，美国总统尼克松访华，开启了美国对中国的接触政策。不过在50年后，有许多的美国学者开始反思接触政策对美国所带来的利弊。那我们今天要来看一看，有一本叫做《美国第二》，美国精英们是如何让中国强大的一本新书。这本书讲述了在美国开启了和中国的接触政策之后，美国的精英们，包括政界、商界和学界的领袖们，受到了中国广大市场的诱惑，是如何成了中国共产党的说客，帮助中国变得更加强大，让中国最终成了美国的对手。美国之音记者思阳最近专访本书的作者 Mr. Isaac Stonefish， 他的中文名字叫做石宇，他曾经在中国生活过6年，担任过《时代周刊》驻北京的记者。石宇在采访中表示，他反共，但是并不反华。我们来看专访内容。
嗨，你好，石宇先生，谢谢您接受我们的采访。那我呢，周末的时候就是把你的书读了一遍，但是 But I still have questions for my audience. So yeah, thanks so much.
好，我也非常感谢有机会跟您聊。非常感谢美国之音有机会广播我这个采访。
So the first question, what is the main message of your book and what motivates you to write such a book?
So 我就一边用中文一边用英文。So what motivated me was when I 我从06年到11年一直在北京，搬到美国的时候，发现很多美国人，尤其是美国的一些 elite 什么的，他那个解释中国、描述中国，不是用独立的语言，也不是用中国人的语言，而是用共产党的语言。So I thought, oh, this is very strange. Why am I back in the States and listening to Americans speak about China and using Chinese language, Chinese type concepts of propaganda? And so I started to research how exactly the Chinese influence came into the United States. And when I was in China talking to people about it, I would always say, oh yeah, you know, 现在是东方压倒西方, but I realized it's not about 东方, 也不是跟中国的影响, 而是共产党的影响。So I wanted to be very clear, you know, as I was writing and as I was doing it, 我不是反华, 我是反党。反华反党两码事，必须隔离这两个概念。
Aside from Kissinger, you also named the names of lots of political leaders and also business leaders. So people say it's so like provocative. Your book is so provocative. So how did these leaders make China strong and compromising the U.S. national security and national interest, in your view?
They suppressed criticism of China and amplified praise and created the system that we've had, you know, until recently, where it was taboo for business leaders, it was taboo for some ex-politicians to be very critical of China. And it's not, oh, 我怎么样也必须说中国的坏话。It's, well, actually, if I'm, you know, 客观的来讲, these are my opinions, these are my views of the country. And there with the idea so long was, well, we can't say these negative things because it could offend the Communist Party, it could offend Chinese people, it could make it more difficult for us to do business in China. And it was just these very constraining frameworks that prevented a really healthy debate in the United States about how we should deal with China. And so over the last several decades, we've had these different intellectual frameworks about how the U.S. should work with China. So in the 70s and 80s, it was, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. China's an enemy of the Soviet Union now, so we should work with China in order to push back against the Soviet Union. And after the Tiananmen Square massacre and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it was, well, that no longer works, and China just massacred students on, you know, in front of a wide world audience, so we need a new justification. Well, how about if we do business with China, they will liberalize. So us expanding our economy into their country will be both better for them and better for us. That was the justification until really the mid-2000s, when China started to grow stronger internationally and started to push against U.S. interests. And then it was, well, we can shape China, we can make them into a responsible stakeholder in the global system that the U.S. built. And really, we're still trying to figure out what this next narrative is. All the other ones have been faulty, especially what happened in the 21st century. And now, really, we're in a place where it's very likely that the U.S. and China will be on opposing sides of a war, and there's not nearly enough national debate. Is that the right way for the U.S. to go? Is that not the right way? How do we talk about this in a way that doesn't get constrained by the business community trying to expand its operations and influence in China?
谢谢您接受我们的采访。
好的，我们非常感谢美国之音记者思阳的专访，也要感谢听众和观众朋友们您的收听和收看。提醒您，受访者发表的是个人观点，不代表美国之音。我是樊东宁，祝各位平安，我们下次节目再会。